I'm really excited to be here tonight, and I really thank you for the invitation. I love any opportunity to talk about the work of Living Child, because it gives a voice for the women and children in really remote parts of Papua New Guinea. And before I engaged in this work, I had no idea of the conditions that women are living in and giving birth in our closest neighbours. So, so thank you for having me. And, I'm going to take you on this crazy journey, which I've been on, and hopefully give you some insights into what I'm starting to see is what good community development looks like. I'm a midwife. I trained 20 years ago at King Edward, and I always had a passion for going and volunteering in a developing country, had done a lot of travelling, but I never thought it would be a reality once I started having children. But this invitation came in 2011 for me to go to this really remote part of Papua New Guinea to train the village birth attendants, and I jumped at the opportunity. So the area that we're working in is the East Sepik province, and you can see Port Moresby down the bottom there, and then you have to go way up to the north west, and you see the town of Wewak. And that's the capital of East Sepik province. But when I say capital, it's just a small, dirty little town, really. That's all that there is. This is a map of the East Sepik province. It's one of the biggest provinces in Papua New Guinea, and it is dominated by the Sepik River, which is actually one of the big, you know, top 10 rivers in the world. And there are not many roads. Those red lines up there are roads, and you can see the roads further north of the picture, but south there are no roads. And the black squiggle here, that's the Kerem River area that we've been working in. And when it shows roads, okay, that means a mud bath, all right? There are very, very few tar roads. So this is an actual aerial shot that I've taken out of the aeroplane window, and this shows the lower Sepik area, which we've been working in. So you can see how it snakes around, and then you've got all those tributaries that come into it. Here I've labelled where things are. So it's not too far to the ocean, so we're in the lower Sepik area, so it's the drainage basin. So it's the real floodplain. There are a lot of swamps, a lot of flat-lying areas, but all those areas are dotted with villages, just hundreds of villages everywhere. You can't see them, but they are there. Thousands of people living in that area. The Kerem River area, that's where we've been working. The town, a few little, you know, shanty towns. Apparently, during the when Australia was there, the time of the Kayaps, and when the war was on, Angaram Town was a thriving place. There was an airstrip, there was a theatre, the hotel, and I've been told by a lot of older people that they had these amazing parties in Angaram. It was a bit of a, you know, town of vice. I think there were a lot of unexpected piccaninnies that were born then. And then there's one road from Angaram to Wewak, and that was built by the Australians by the Australian military in about 1963. I've been desperately keep banging on the doors of Parliament to try and get it tarred, but it's still not tarred. So what does a village look like? So this is one of the smaller rivers, and this is the village of Yamen. And this was just taken in March, and the river is up high. And the next picture shows when the river is quite low. So you can see there's this huge drop, depending on the rainfall from the highlands coming down this area. The people are subsistence farmers. So here are some crops of taro and other greens and bananas, but your typical tropical fruits. They are also now growing vanilla and are trying to and are selling that. So that industry is growing in this area. Cocoa has taken a bit of a battering because of some moth, but I think that they're trying to stimulate that again. And in the village of Yamen, they are now growing rice, and they are producing rice and supplying it to the rest of the province and trying to get it out to the rest of the country, which is really exciting. And that's only just happened in the last few years. These little kids are fishing, and the river is the source of life for these people. They do everything in the river. They wash, they ablute, they fish, they do everything. So the river is the source of their life, and they're called the river people. Their lives are very Spartan. This is a typical interior of a house, and you can just see there's the bit of the cooking stove. They've got a kettle, maybe two bowls to make their sago, which is forms a staple part of their diet. And look, I mean, just a few Spartan pieces of equipment. And, of course, the baby hanging in the billum. If you look on the left there, okay. So that's a typical scene in the villages there. Health services, well, non-existent. This is a, you can see the remnants of what was there. And this actual health centre, can you believe it? Now, this is one of the reasons where I thought, oh, I'm from Perth. Okay, there's good connections. Because this health centre was built by six volunteers from Bethesda Hospital in Perth. And it was built in the 1960s. Can you believe it? I couldn't believe it. In this really, really remote village. And this equipment is all from the 60s and the 70s, but not being used at the moment. So no, so for many years, there's just been very little governance in East Sepik province, very little supervision, coordination for services, especially in the remote areas. Because one of the big challenges in PNG is that 90% of the population live in the remote areas. And when it's remote, it is very remote because of the difficulties getting anywhere. So what does that mean for women? Well, it is a challenge. This is a photo of a woman. She was having her eighth baby, desperately trying to get to the health centre to deliver. Delivered the baby on the side of the river. And this is a typical scene. And when they deliver their babies, they just let them come out onto the ground. They're afraid to touch the baby or to pick the baby up until it cries for the first time. So they just leave it there. And they're also, there's a lot of taboos around touching the amniotic fluid or any blood. So they don't touch the baby until someone else comes and scoops it up and washes it, and then they hand it to the mother if it is breathing and showing signs of life. This is a close-up photo of a piece of bamboo that was used to cut the umbilical cord. So that's what's being used, and you can imagine that that is a source of infection, especially tetanus. So these are, and this is another challenge, is that this was the referral, the site of the referral hospital for women to come to supposedly get help. But they were relegated to the disused laundry, and that piece of cardboard there was the only bit of cleanliness on the ground for the woman to give birth in. So many, many women died in that laundry, because of a lack of care, a lack of equipment, a lack of services. So many, many women have died. and babies. So the state at the moment for Papua New Guinea is that there's a very high fertility rate. The government is really concerned about population. Yeah, they're estimating that it's around 8 million, but it is growing at an extraordinary rate because there is the access to family planning, or contraceptives is very difficult for the majority of the population. And the official stats are that women are having about 6.6 babies. But in the villages, they were telling me if they survive, then they are having 9 to 14 pregnancies. Yes. Yeah. So it's going back to things, you know, this was the norm for women at the, you know, the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, wasn't it? Yeah. The maternal mortality rate. Now, if you have a look at the World Bank site, they will say it's around 250 per 100,000. But the 733, that is the true statistic for the maternal mortality rate in Papua New Guinea, compared to Australia, which is 6.8 per 100,000. So you can see it's very high. And at a conference in Port Moresby, they said that is 5 mothers every day dying in childbirth. 5 every day, just because they're pregnant. The infant mortality rate is between 50 to 80 per 1,000, and the provincial obstetrician has told me that it's even greater than 100 in East Sepik province, compared to 4 per 1,000 in Australia. Child mortality for children under 5 is 54 per 1,000. Regional Australia, it's 4.9 per 1,000. And again, you know, those stats, that a lot of them are not taking into account the rural areas because there simply are no statistics. There are no records for a lot of these remote areas. 67% of women experience domestic violence, and 1 in 2 women have been raped. It is horrendous, horrendous statistics. So women really do it tough in Papua New Guinea. In terms of the causes of mothers dying, and this was from the medical symposium in 2015 in Papua New Guinea, the major cause is hemorrhage. So 35% of mothers, and that's completely preventable. Puerperal sepsis, 25%. Again, completely preventable with good care and antibiotics. And the third biggest reason is medical. So that's where they've got other conditions. So whether it's a sexually transmitted infection, such as gonorrhea, usually syphilis or HIV, those are the two big ones. But TB is another killer of pregnant women, malaria, and cervical cancer is very, very high. So HPV infection is very high in these areas. But, like I've said there, in the rural areas, babies are not getting birth certificates, so there's no record of them being born. And when a mother or a baby dies, there's no record. There's no reporting. So they, you know, when a tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear? That's what's been happening in Papua New Guinea. So I'm a midwife and I love reading the research and knowing, well, what things does the research show that work? And the evidence shows that, and the scope of practice of a midwife. So I don't know if you know, but a midwife is qualified to be able to look after families around preconceptual care, so that's all family planning, preparing to fall pregnant, antenatal care when they're pregnant, care during labour and birth, care after the birth, and the baby right up till 6 weeks. So that's our sort of official scope of practice. And I like to look at it as this nice circle. So the evidence shows that if you've got good access to family planning, and that means nutrition and good preparation for falling pregnant, okay, that puts you in a better stead. Quality antenatal care, what does that mean? Well, that you have regular checkups during your pregnancy, and that includes that your blood pressure is checked, your urine is tested, you are vaccinated against common illnesses that can affect you and the health of the baby, and that there is monitoring through the pregnancy to check how the baby is growing and how the mother's health is during the pregnancy. That's what quality antenatal care is. That when it comes time to giving birth, that you give birth, have a supervised birth with someone who's qualified to look after you. And the World Health Organization recommends that you give birth in a health facility, but that that health facility has got equipment and it's got well-trained staff. The other part of evidence-based care is the postnatal period, because a lot of mothers are dying after birth. So quality postnatal care is help with breastfeeding, checking on the mother, making sure there's no signs of infection, and providing immunizations. And then it goes back to family planning. So that's why I call it that cycle of good care. So that's what we're aiming at, okay? But what is the reality in Papua New Guinea at the moment? And then how did I then decide what we do? Where do we start? So the reason that I'm in this area is because there was a Church of Christ pastor, Mike Bullard. His kids were at the same school as my kids, and he'd been travelling up to PNG to do training with the pastors. And he was one of those rare people who said, take me out to the remote areas. So off he went. And he was talking to the men, and he said, what are your biggest needs out here? And they immediately said, we need training for our traditional birth attendants because our mothers are dying. And so many mothers were dying that it was changing the whole community. So Mike remembered that I was a midwife, and he came back to Perth and he asked me if I would be interested in going up there. So I said yes, because I had just got a bit fed up working in hospitals here and wanted to do something different. And I'd been looking at around at where I could volunteer, but a lot of agencies wanted me for 4 to 6 weeks minimum, and I still had kids in primary school. But Mike's offer was for just under 2 weeks, and I said, okay, I can do that. So off we went in August 2012. Now, I had a look at the evidence. I did a bit of reading about Papua New Guinea. I tried to speak to a few different agencies, but a lot of agencies are not happy to share their information. So there was a bit of stonewalling, you know, who does this midwife think she is? And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go with a clean slate. And I'm going to go, I'm responding to a need, but I'm going to listen. I want to go and listen to the woman and their stories. I'm going to look for myself. I want to see what services there are, what's happening in their village. I want to learn about their ways, because it's no use me going in with my Western ideas and saying, you need to do this, this, and this, and this. These people, they're the ones who are living there. And I wanted to really love these women. Now, I grew up in South Africa, so I had a connection to Africans, but I hadn't really come across PNG culture before. And so I knew I needed to learn about their culture and actually learn to love these people. And, of course, the other thing is to just reflect on everything and then let that inform what I was going to do in the community. This picture is really special to me because that is the first photo on the first morning of supposed training. And the men in the surrounding villages, they had selected two women from each village to come to the training. So there were about 80 women from about 18 to 20. Yeah, there were about 20 different villages represented and then a few add-ons. And some of them had had some training with Save the Children Fund, but more than 10 years ago. A lot of them were brand new because their village birth attendant had died in childbirth. And I remember just standing up the front here and look at them. They're all looking at me. And I was thinking, oh, my goodness, where do we start? But I started with that the nurse that I was with, a friend of mine from Perth, we just shared our stories of our own pregnancy and birth. For me, I will never forget that I could have died if I didn't have access to a cesarean section here in Australia. And that's a big thing for a midwife to say that, so you know that I really did need a cesarean section. But what happened is that as I shared that story, they could see that actually this is something that doesn't just affect us, it affects all women around the world, okay? But with good care and with the right help at the right time, lives could be saved. So as we shared these stories, we then invited the woman to open up and tell us their stories. And this is where we just heard from them that women were dying from bleeding to death. They were dying because their placentas were not being delivered, and so then they bled to death. Or the placenta then became infected, and usually they died around 2 weeks later. They also then told us about the baby. So a lot of babies were dying because they were just delivered onto the ground and that they were just sort of left there to see what would happen. Umbilical cords were being cut with dirty implements, and that babies then got umbilical cord infections and died from overwhelming infections. And they also said that a lot of babies would be covered in all sorts of rashes, pustules all over them, and would die. So from that, you can tell that there's probably some sexually transmitted infections that are just not being treated, and babies are dying from overwhelming infection. The women were in a place of hopelessness, of helplessness, and they were in a rut. That was my sense. And I had a real sense that they were actually quite traumatized by what they had seen. Every woman here had experienced the death of a woman. Isn't that sad? So when I heard these stories, I felt quite overwhelmed, really. And I thought, you know, well, how are we going to move from hearing all these really traumatic stories? And I am a Christian. And in that moment, and this is a very Christian area, and I thought, you know, I think we need to pray. So I said to the woman, I said, would you mind if we just said a prayer for all those mothers and babies that have died? And then we'll just pray and ask God to help us that today is the beginning of new beginnings, and that from this day onwards, there'll be some really good things that'll happen. So I didn't know Melanesian culture very well, but when they pray, they all pray together. So what happened is that I started to say a prayer. I was feeling very, you know, sheepish and not quite sure what to say. And then all the women joined in. And then there was this beautiful, like, voice, like almost like a song of prayers that went up. And we did that, and then we got to work. And it was just quite profound because they were ready and they were so keen to learn. So what did I start with? Well, they knew nothing about their bodies. Most of these women were illiterate, had maybe a grade 3 of primary school education. So we started with teaching them about their bodies, about how their body works. We did a lot of group discussions where just talking about what a healthy pregnancy looks like. You know, that you need to eat well, that you need to drink plenty of water, that you need to go down to the health centre for a checkup. And I knew there were no health centres, but we started those conversations right from day one, because that's what evidence-based care is, to plant those seeds of what good care should look like. We did a lot of role plays. We did role plays, I called them the road to death and then the road to life, and got them to come up with some stories. They've all got a story. They know what it looks like. So what is that road to death? Well, it's no family planning, not going to the clinic to get checked, having a checkup. It's all of those really basic things. The road to life is where the community works together, takes the woman to the clinic for checkups. When there's a danger sign in pregnancy, they don't wait. They start evacuating her sooner rather than later because of the distances that they're going to have, that they deal with. We also took up clean birth kits. Now, I'd never heard of a clean birth kit before, but there it is. It is a clean piece of plastic for the woman to give birth on. It is gloves and soap so that whoever's helping her can wash her hands and protect herself and keep things clean. It is three pieces of string to tie the umbilical cord. The third piece of string is just in case one falls in the dirt. It is a clean scalpel blade to cut the cord so it's nice and clean. And it's some gauze so that you can wipe the baby's eyes. You can use some gauze to clear the airway of the baby. Often babies are born with mucus stuck right down the back of their throats. And also used to clean the perineal area if it needs to be cleaned up. And that all fits into a Ziploc sandwich bag. Okay? So we took a whole lot of those and we did training around that. We also did essential newborn care so that when the baby is delivered, the baby is lifted onto the mother's chest, the baby is dried and stimulated, the airway is cleared, and the baby is given first breast milk, because they were not doing that. Now, when a baby suckles at the breast, it helps to contract the uterus. And then that helps to expel the placenta. So very, very basic things, but we just role played over and over and over again. And what we saw is that they went away and they put these things into practice, and then they came back to us when we went up again, probably 7-8 months later, and they were telling us stories of how they were applying this new knowledge and it was working. They were so proud of themselves and they were so excited. So then they came back to us and they were ready for more. So then we could give them some more and we went to the next stage. So the next stage we went to was because they were also telling us that they were actually going to other villages, not even their own, because they were so excited about this new information. And that they were training these other people and other women. So we thought, oh, we better give them some skills on how to teach. And so one of the ways we did that is to get them to come up with songs and their own stories about specific health messages that they want to tell other people. So, for instance, this is a group of women and they have put together a song about the danger signs. So the danger signs in pregnancy. So they put it to a song that they knew, which was Amazing Grace, that they loved. They chose that. And then just starting from the head, going down to the feet, just any of the signs or symptoms that are in a woman that mean that she mustn't hang around in the village and give birth there. They need to kissim canoe, get the canoe, and start travelling down to the house, to the health centre, because that's a risk. She's at risk of dying. The other thing that we did is got them to come up with their own plays and stories. And because there was so much death of mothers in their village, often they chose to do something around that. And we then got, at the end of the time that we were there, they did a presentation to the whole community. And it was really powerful because there were times when they got to where the mother died because the father wouldn't allow them to use their boat to get them down to the health sick, because the men are concerned about blood getting on their boat and cursing their boat. Okay? So they did these role plays and these dramas addressing these cultural taboos that were affecting the health of women. And when it came to the mother dying, I remember this one, it was this night where I filmed this, there were some kids that laughed. And the men, they really shouted at the children and they said, "This is not a laughing matter. These are our mothers who are dying." And it was a very powerful experience because the men were standing up and saying, this is real for us and this is not right and we need to address it. And it is muffled and it's dark. There's no power there or anything. But this was one of the amazing songs that the woman put together when the mother had died. About 1,000 village people there, and it's quiet. And these women were singing the song to the mother. We are sorry that we didn't have money for a canoe. We are sorry that you have died. We are sorry, you know, really, really powerful. And then they've told me that they've taken these stories and these dramas back to other villages. And it's had a profound and a powerful effect on the whole community because it's highlighting what the problem is and it's saying we need to do something about it, which has just been incredible. So, So the other thing that we've done is we've also left models and teaching resources. And we've identified women who have shown real aptitude for teaching. You can tell that they're the leaders in the community. And we've equipped them and we've just encouraged them. Go and, you know, share this information that you have. The other thing that has sort of developed is that as they've gained confidence, they've then come back with more questions, okay? And so then we've realised that you know, they're bright people. Let them come up to the solutions to their own problems. And so we've just run sessions. We've just got them together. We've said, you sit down, you talk about what are the main problems in your community. So you can do that using, I don't know if you've heard of, it's called the problem tree. So the branches of the tree are all the problems, and then the roots are what are causing those problems. And then you can come up, then you choose one problem, and then we've used the tree again, and they've chosen that one problem, and then all the branches are the solutions to those problems. And we've seen that as being really, really powerful. So the woman in the communities, their biggest problem is access, okay? And they don't have the power to say, I need to go down to the health centre, because the men are the gatekeepers. They've got the boats. They've got the money for fuel or whatever is needed. So the woman cannot do anything without the men's permission and authority. So this creates quite a bit of a problem in the community. And so the solutions that they've come up with are that they're going to have their own little emergency fund. Isn't that amazing what they've come up with? And when a woman is pregnant, so there's going to be this community slush fund, and when a woman is pregnant, if she needs emergency treatment, they use that money so that she can get the care that she needs immediately. Isn't that amazing? Just a simple thing like that. I love it. It excites me to see them come up with their, you know, solutions to their own problems. Family planning was one of the first things that they asked me for on that very first trip in 2012. And I stood there and I remember just my eyes went to heaven and I just thought, where am I going to get family planning contraceptives out to this place through customs? You know, my mind was, you know, out of Australia, through customs out here. But they, you know, a woman, when I said to them, what do you, you know, what is one of your greatest needs, you know, from me and while we're here? And a woman just fell at my feet and said, space in Piccaninny, family planning. But amazingly, I was put through, it was actually through Bruce Robinson's organisation, and it's just gone out of my head, but they do emergency training in developing countries. And I saw an article in the paper, contacted them. They put me in touch with an obstetrician in Papua New Guinea, who then put me in touch with a Rotarian who was doing a family planning program with contraceptive implants. So it was government endorsed, and off we went. We got permission from the senior obstetrician, but the men are the gatekeepers, so we had to engage the men. Now, there might be some of you ladies here who remember when contraceptives were first introduced, what was it, in the 60s, and the outcry and all the concerns that were raised in those days, that women were going to be promiscuous and, okay, do you remember all of those? I've had a lot of ladies tell me that, oh, yeah, nothing new. Those were the concerns of the men in these communities, that the women were now going to be raving sex lunatics and just having sex with everyone, okay? So we had to stick to our evidence-based information, and that's what we did. We didn't get caught up in all the emotion of the discussion because it got quite robust at times. We stuck to the facts. There were some key men who were very supportive, and they were the ones who mediated the discussions around family planning. Now, normally in PNG, you've got men sitting on one side, women on the other, as in that picture there. But what they did is that they got everyone to sit with their partners, and they said, this is a family decision. Isn't that powerful? And after a lot of discussions, so we started the discussions in 2013, and in 2014 we were then given permission to use the contraceptive implants. And that has had a profound impact on the whole communities, and especially the health and well-being of mothers. In 2017, we conducted a community feedback workshop, and there were representatives, men and women, from that whole Kerem River area, and we asked them three questions. What are the good things that are happening in your community since Living Child Training? What are still some issues for you? And what do you think the solutions to those issues are? And I thought we were just going to get negative feedback because there are still some significant problems in these villages and health challenges. But, you know, all areas said they hadn't had any maternal deaths. I mean, that's phenomenal. No maternal deaths because they were able to identify problems earlier. They were evacuating those women earlier and they could see that that was saving lives. They were also noticing that there were fewer infections in mothers and babies because of the clean birth kits. And happier mothers due to the contraceptive implants. They said the mothers didn't have a baby in the belly, a baby on their hip and a toddler at their foot, and that mothers were enjoying the garden, preparing food for the families and were just generally happier and lighter. So that was really amazing. And I thought, wow, that's good. Okay, that's working. So what's happening in the remote areas? The village birth attendants are doing an amazing job teaching their communities, identifying problems, making it nice and clean for the mothers at birth. But they're still not really skilled, are they? They've got a little bit of knowledge. We need someone who's really well trained and who can support those village birth attendants. And so our next thing was to get a midwife and get maternity services operating again at Angaram Health Centre, so that all those village birth attendants, they could send those mothers down to her. And so that was the next thing that we started doing. We started by conducting some training with the health workers that were actually at that district hospital. And we did that in 2017, and we had 16 people come. They told us they had not had any continuing professional development training for over 20 years. So it was a bit slow, but we got there. So we trained them. We also provided some equipment for the labour room. Melville Rotary were significant donors for us getting this equipment up there. And then we managed to recruit a Papua New Guinean midwife who was from the CPIC area, but she'd been living and working in the Highlands for 20 years. And I'd happened to be connected with her through the Australian College of Midwives, and she'd said to me many years before, she said, "Sarah, one day I want to come and work for Living Child." Well, I didn't want to hire anyone because of all the bureaucracy and the red tape. But what we did is we managed to facilitate for her to be employed by the East CPIC government, health department, and get her out to that Angaram Health Centre. And our role as Living Child is to provide some professional support, encouragement, some in-service training, and work closely with her in supporting her as she gets maternal services up and running again. So this is the first little baby that was born there just in May last year. And since then, I think over 100 babies have been delivered, safely delivered. I think there's been two babies that have died. And she was devastated about that, but really there was nothing she could have done. And no mothers have lost their lives, so which has been pretty significant. So, of course, when we moved to getting the midwife there, then the remote people were saying, "Oh, you're forgetting about us." So this year we have been focusing again on those remote areas and just providing a lot more support for them, to do the training out in their villages. So we've been equipping them. They are now asking, they're recognising that they need to wash hands and have clean drinking water. So we're doing programs with them to help them to be able to improve general health for their families. And I'll just, in regards to our DFAT funding that we've just got, so we're inaugural grant recipients of $56,000 with a friendship grant, and I think I've run out of time, but you'll be able to ask Julie some questions. But Julie, come down. So Julie is a Papua New Guinean nurse who lives around the corner from me, and she's come on board, and part of what she's doing is a men's health training program, and that's forming part of our DFAT funding. And we're also doing midwife training, so upskilling of midwives, but in WIWAC, for the whole province now. So that's where the DFAT funding has come to really give us a lift up and support us in that. So I just want to finish before some questions. Mother Teresa said, if I look at the mass, I will never act. But if I look at the one, I will. And this little baby is baby Caitlin. She was 5 months old there in 2013. And her mother, she was a twin, and her mother died in childbirth because of infection. And when I heard her story and I held Caitlin, I just thought, when you get to the age of having children of your own, I do not want you to suffer the same way that your mother did. I want to make sure that you have access to family planning, that you've got good care in pregnancy, that you can have a safe birth, and that you're well supported as you start your journey as a mother. So that's our goal for her. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad that you all clapped, because I was just going to say the exact same thing when you said between you started in 2012 and then 2017 to have no mothers die is an absolutely amazing achievement. So, as I said at the outset, I heard your story when you were talking on a radio program, and incredibly inspirational, and just makes me really proud as a West Australian and a person living in Perth to know that there are people like you, you know, helping in these particular areas, and I just feel like we need more people like you in our communities. So thank you very much for sharing that story with us tonight, Sarah, and I do want to open up. Did you
want to
say anything before we open up?
Sorry, I've taken the whole stage. This is, you know, it is a team effort, and I could not do this without an amazing team that I have around me and people who've come aboard. So Julie's going to come here so we can ask her some questions as well, and she's been just absolutely incredible in helping us do further community development, and especially this men's health program. So,
Come forward, come and tell us about what you're doing as well.
Evening on. So, like, I went with Sarah in 2017. That was my first time that I went with her. I didn't know. I just lived around a corner from her, but I didn't know that she was doing work there in Papua New Guinea. I went when I learned about what she was doing. I said, why not, you know, go back and give back to my community. So I went with her in 2017. And when we were there, we were doing this community engagement with all the people there. And I saw that a lot of the men were there, because they were curious to know what was going on with the trainings and stuff. And then after that, we did the implants, and I was also helping Sarah to do the implants. And I kept telling the women, you know, abstain from sex for 1 week. And I kept sending them away and thinking, wow, when they get back to their houses, would the husband understand the importance of, you know, abstaining for that 1 week? And I didn't get my answer from there, but when we came back, I told Sarah, Sarah, you know, we need to do something with the men to get them, you know, for them to also understand so that it makes it balanced for the both husband and wife in their homes. So this year, Sarah said, okay, so with the help and the funding, this year we went in March, and I just developed some questions, just basic questions, just to get the views from the men. And we were lucky enough to get one of the midwives, a male midwife from Western Australia, to go with us, with the local men back in the village, the health workers there, and just gave them those questions and then asked them to just do focus group discussion with the men, just to get their views about all this stuff. And when they did it, it was overwhelming when we get all the answers back and the feedback from the men. And we didn't realize that there were other things, bigger issues there as well. Just to name a few, like domestic violence is there, and abuse of young girls and women. Yeah, so we came back and now we're working, trying to put something together, something small to start off with. So when we went, the plan was to have just a handful of men, maybe 20 or 30 in each areas. But when we went, the turnout of men that came, it was over 100. And we said, okay, what can we do with all of them? Send them away? No. So the men decided to just split them into different groups, like the younger men and the middle-aged and the older men, just to get their views. And out of that, we came, you know, with a lot of things. So now we're planning to go back in August. So we're getting some pastors on board, because back in Papua New Guinea, there's a lot people look up on leaders like pastors. And if you don't have a health worker there, you have a teacher in the area or in the village, which is remote, they would have one teacher in an area just that everyone could look upon as a person for them to go to. So we decide maybe we take some pastors with us to go back in March and just to start off with few little trainings and awareness to the men, and then we'll build up from there. And yeah, so that's the plan.
Hi, I'm just wondering how you went with kind of the language or communication barrier and how you overcame that.
So there are over 900 languages in Papua New Guinea, but they what's happened is that they now talk pidgin, so that's the pidgin English. It's meant to be a uniting language. There was always at least one woman who had a bit of education, so she would help with interpretation. But I also worked really hard to learn the words. So I'm fairly good at talking about sexual and reproductive health in Tok Pidgin, but your general niceties, I'm not that good, am I? But having Julie, and there are some other PNG volunteers from Perth on the team, it's just improved communication drastically. Definitely.
Thank you so much for your talk. I'm immensely impressed by the involvement of the community. I have done a lot of work with mothers and babies here in Perth. I'm a clinical psychologist. And if we could involve the community in the way you have, I think we'd be doing a lot of very good things for mothers. And we need to try to learn from you, I think. But one question I have is, do mothers suffer very much from postnatal depression, or is that more a Western thing?
I would say it's a definite yes. Like I said, that first time that I went there, I just found the women were all, they were actually in a state of trauma, really traumatized. And they, I hate it when I hear when people say, oh, well, they, you know, they lose babies all the time, so, you know, they get used to it. No. When a mother loses a baby or a mother experiences deep distress in her relationship or her family, they suffer significant depression. And we've also, you know, really seen mothers, I mean, I've heard terrible stories where because they're just pregnant, they were pregnant all the time. They didn't want this baby. So imagine those feelings that would come up inside of them. And there was one midwife in Papua New Guinea who told me that she, this woman was dying, was bleeding to death, and the mother actually pushed her away and said, leave me to die. Because this was her, you know, 10th baby. She was exhausted. She just wanted to die, you know. So, yes, I would say definitely. Look, I just, well, that's why I just feel it's actually, and I've told the community this, that one of my responsibilities is to be a voice for the community, to tell the stories that this is the reality for people right here, right now. And Living Child is growing. We are, I've been a volunteer now for 7 years. It is unsustainable for me to continue being a volunteer. If you would like to support Living Child, we would love to hear from you. We've got tax deductible status, we've got everything now. But so we're moving to the stage where we need to look at ways of, you know, this is a full-time job and it's growing, it's working. So if you want to come on board, if you want to volunteer, if you want to share your knowledge and experience, we'd love to hear from anyone.
Where do you get money for those birthing?
Well, last year I managed to get a grant from the Birthing Kit Foundation, and so we've got kits arriving up there now. We're getting $5,000 a year for the next 3 years. But you know, the potential to expand that program is there. We just don't have the resources or the people to be able to do it. So, but our motto is that we just do what we can, you know, and we tell the community that too. We're very open with the community. They thought they'd heard on the grapevine that we got Australian aid. So they immediately thought we got millions. We had to be very open with them and say, this is very limited. We are all volunteers. I've often said, you know, I'm a mother. so you've got to do it. We're just here to work in partnership, but you've actually got to do the work.
Yeah. Some of the statistics you put up at the start were about domestic violence. I just wonder how your program is faring under that and whether there's a diminishing incidence of domestic violence as a result of the work you're doing.
Yeah. So we haven't done the domestic violence training yet, but certainly with the work that we're doing, what we're seeing is that we're seeing some amazing men. We are seeing some real strong men. No, but, well, the problem is with PNG is that the men get a bad rap, okay? You mention PNG and they'll just go straight to the men and the men are violent, you know, so they do get a bad rap. And then you've got a statistic like that about domestic violence. But what we're seeing, like I've had men come to me in tears saying, can you just explain to me again the fertility cycle so that I know when my wife is safe? I don't want her to fall pregnant. I don't want to lose her, okay? So there are some amazing men there. And I think what our work has done, it's really encouraged those men to speak up. And I think that's why the work that Julie is doing now is so timely, because those men are speaking up and saying, hey, domestic violence is a problem. And it's a problem with the men and we need to do something about it. our girls are being abused, this is a problem. So I do believe that they're getting a voice, they're finding their voice and being encouraged.
Look, prior to the white person coming to New Guinea and Papua, how did the birthing process take? Have they lost the traditional means of keeping mother and baby alive? What has happened to what was must have been traditional ways? Can you give me some idea?
I'm from Papua New Guinea, but not from that area. But we are so different in different areas, and different cultures, different areas have different cultures and ways. And I'm not really sure where what they do in that area. But I think from a lot of the mothers are dying because of infection, from what I know from the remote areas of Papua New Guinea. A lot of the women are dying because of infection, and now because of the changes, a lot of the things are changing, and cultures right in the village, the younger ones coming up, they're not practicing our cultures anymore. It's starting to die off, and those are also affecting the mothers in the, like in the olden days, women there in one, in the houses, and all the men are in a, they call it a houseman. So that's where all the men are there. And it's sort of like family planning comes in that way too, because a lot of the men would be in those areas, in the houseman, and they only come and visit at times in the family home where the women and the babies are. And that's where family planning comes on. But now it's so different. A lot of the communities, the houseman is no longer there, or houseman for the men to stay. They're all mixed up in a home. So things like that has died out. And a lot of things with family planning is also dying out. So.
And also we have heard, you know, with the advent of social media, smartphones, even in those remote areas, people get access to stuff. When the data is down, they still get access. So there is a real problem with pornography in PNG. And I think this is really affecting men, and they're talking about this. So it'll be interesting to see with our training and as we do a bit more work in this area, whether they are identifying it as a, like a source of, you know, causing a bit of a problem for boys and men abusing girls because they're seeing this being acted out. Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah and Julie, for a wonderful presentation. Do I understand you correctly in that Living Child is based solely in the CPIC?
Yes, at the moment we are. We get lots of invitations to other areas, but, yeah, we're at our capacity.
And do you know, because I worked in PNG from 84 to 86 as a midwife in the Morobe province, and that's going back a long time ago, and it was nothing like what you've just said, and we had plenty of problems then. But this has, like, gone back hundreds of years from my experience. So my question is, do you know that there are other places like the CPIC with their health issues?
Yeah, so what's happened is that there were really good health services around Australia, around Papua New Guinea. Like ECPIC was regarded as the best. Like I've heard a lot of people, they used to go to WIWAC to have their baby from all over the country. But since the mid-80s, there's just been this steady decline. So you can see evidence of, you know, you can see that infrastructure trail of what it used to be like, but there's nothing functioning now. We have heard, and Linda Tano, the midwife at Angaram, she's told us that Angaram and ECPIC is the worst in the country. and Angram in particular is the worst. So I don't know if you know, there's a massive polio outbreak in Papua New Guinea at the moment. Angram district is the worst in the country.
Thank you so much for the presentation tonight. Really amazing. I'm not a healthcare professional, but I do work closely with several Indigenous health organisations in WA, and I think one thing that's come through in tonight's presentation is the importance of community-led organisation in the health space. Not knowing much about PNG's healthcare more broadly, past maternal care, is this a model that could be used in terms of health provision more broadly across the country? And is this something that the government is looking at there?
You know, I gave a similar presentation to this at the Australian College of Midwives last year, and there were Aboriginal midwives and health workers present. They came up to me with tears in their eyes, and they said, "We need what you are doing in Papua New Guinea." And I know that even at the highest level in the health department, it's certainly in terms of midwifery, we are saying this is what the government needs to be doing. They are not engaging with the community enough. They are not listening and getting to that grassroots stuff. It's still very much telling what to do and how to do it. And these women are disengaged. And one of the Papua New Guinea, the Aboriginal midwife, she said to me, they just get so disheartened because the government gives money. They then set up these services. There are Western people in control. The health workers are doing the work. They're seeing massive improvements, wonderful engagement, then the funding's cut. Those Aboriginal people lose their jobs, and they're the ones that have to face the community, and they have to say, you know, and they said it's devastating for them. So, yeah, don't worry, I'll be... I'll keep advocating.
Sarah, that presentation just shocked me. It was unbelievable, the low level of community ability to deal with the simplest phenomenon for human beings. What you're doing there is just astounding. And so my question, though, is this representative of the whole of Papua New Guinea? That's my first question. The second question is, this is more of an AIIA question. Australia seems to have taken a bit of a backward step from the Pacific in lots of different ways, and China's coming in to fill the breach, if you like. Can you imagine the Chinese government doing anything like what you're doing as their imprimatur in Papua New Guinea increases, and it will continue to do so? Julie, I last couple of weeks have been in Darwin and engaged with a woman from the Highlands, and we were visiting the Tiwi Islands together, and I can't imagine that in Goroka, of all places, anything like this would be possible. So, I mean, I'm both absolutely devastated to hear your story, Sarah, and at the same time delighted that you're actually doing something about this appalling situation.
I think, yes, there are areas like this that are the same. I get people contacting me and saying we are desperate for more training. And one of my, what I would like to do is actually put together a training package for village birth attendants that's standardised, simple, and that any groups that are going to Papua New Guinea to do similar work, any midwives, they could then use that material safely. I think, now what was your other question in regards to that China? Yes, okay. I mean, that's the reason why we've got a friendship grant, okay? Australia has suddenly realised that China is muscling in.
We are way after the event.
Yes. It was very sad that Australia chose Papua New Guinea to send refugees as well, when they were struggling to deal with their own people. And I think certainly my experience of people in the really remote areas, they love Australia. They really love Australia. And to know that that we are coming from Australia really warms their heart. And that's the message I want to keep telling Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and the government, is that this is really important for Australia, Papua New Guinea relations, and that just throwing money, big money, at big organisations in Port Moresby is not helping the rest of the majority of the population, and that they need to get behind grassroots, smaller organisations that are meeting the community where they're at. And with that, the groundswell of support for Australia will grow. And, you know, one man in the village, he said to me, you know, Sarah, Australia doesn't realise there's a whole generation of kids not being educated. Does Australia realise that?
No.
A whole generation of kids not being educated, and a huge population that has not been properly recorded either. Nobody really knows how many people there are because the census hasn't been done properly. And you've got that. That could be a security risk. They also, the level of sexually transmitted infections, because there's no screening and treatment, that is a biohazard happening there as well, with antibiotic resistance. So I think Australia is taking notice, but they have been slow. But our hope is to, you know, push them on.